cutting through an overload of information to get to the heart of the story. This is The Point.
Global trade was expected to shrink by nearly 5% in 2023, according to a United Nations estimate last December. The UN report shows geopolitics is increasingly impacting global trade patterns. The most vivid example is friendshoring, that is, trading with politically aligned partners more. Meanwhile, China will strengthen its major trading partner status with over 140 countries, with new energy vehicles, solar panels and lithium battery exports growing rapidly. How will these contradictory dynamics affect us all? How can global governance on trade catch up with the ever-complex challenges? And finally, is multilateralism under attack, as WTO Director General Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala warned in Abu Dhabi last month? Welcome to this special edition of The Point with me, Liu Xin, coming to you from Beijing. I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Roberto Azevedo, former Director General of the World Trade Organization from 2013 to 2020. During his term, the WTO reached the first multilateral agreement in 18 years, the Trade Facilitation Agreement. He has just been appointed a council member of Shenzhen Court of International Arbitration in southern China. He's now engaged in teaching, consulting and financial services. Mr. Azevedo, how good to see you again in Beijing.
It's really a pleasure to be here with you again.
Thank you. The last time we saw each other was 2016, I believe,
It's been a while.
It's been a while, and a lot has happened. A lot of fluctuations in global trade, for sure. As I mentioned, the United Nations estimated that global trade for 2023 last year will have dropped by 5%. How do you look at that number? Is that within still terms that are acceptable given the kind of forces that are at play now?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think that drop is mostly in value, not necessarily volume. So that's something to be mindful of, because it may be affected by commodity prices, for example, which oscillate quite a bit. But let me say this, when I was at the WTO, trade was already slowing down, and slowing down significantly globally. And I would call in the economists, right, my chief economists and others, to discuss a little bit the impact. Why is this happening? What are the factors that are provoking this slowdown? And every single time I had different explanations. So in the beginning, it was, we had record trade growth in the past before 2008, but that was abnormal. This is not the norm. So we're going back to more stable economic and trade growth. Then it was about different factors, a drought somewhere, or different circumstances. I think if you talk to economists, there will always be a number of explanations. Mm. But today it is very difficult to consider or imagine that this number is not being affected by geopolitics and is not being affected by the decision of governments to onshore the productive process or nearshore the productive process or friendshore the product. Yeah. I think somehow that has an impact. I can't quantify that. I don't think anybody can. But it's clearly playing a role there.
How is that impacting the ordinary pals and girls on the street? I remember a couple of years ago we were talking about 3% or 2%. People were already complaining that trade was growing slower than economy, and now we're seeing a 5% decline of trade.
Generally, when trade declines, economic growth is also not very robust, right?
So the or maybe vice versa?
It's the egg and the chicken. It's okay. Difficult to tell which is which. I hear different explanations, but clearly, if the economy is growing, trade tends to grow along. So if trade is slowing down, it could be an indicator that the global economy is also slowing down. It is not necessarily so, but it's an indicator nonetheless. I think the main impact for the common person, the common citizen in any country, when trade slows down, is usually domestic prices go up. Because imports tend to have an anti-inflationary effect in the economy. It's more competition, it's more supply, and of course, with more supply, prices tend to be contained. Mm. The moment that you begin to, for whatever reason, stop the imports or reduce the imports considerably, the first effect I think consumers and the citizen will feel is prices are going up, therefore purchasing power diminishes. So your salary went down. Basically, that's the major impact.
We'll talk about that in just a moment. One of the more significant trends that were pointed out in this UN report is the more prominent trend of friendshoring. As I mentioned, countries seem to prefer to trade more with their politically aligned partners. And the report mentioned especially the lengthening, quote unquote, the lengthening of supply chains, particularly between China and the United States. So how do you comment on that trend? And again, for the ordinary people, what does that mean?
Well, that means that most companies in the US and internationally, they are diversifying supply. So China used to be the hub. China used to be the supplier. Some called it the global factory, right? Today, people are diversifying. Okay, they may continue to import from China, but they're also importing from Vietnam. They may also be importing from Brazil. They may also be importing from Europe. They will diversify to mitigate risks, to minimize risks. And that, I think, is a tendency, is a trend that is not going to disappear in the near term. The pandemic showed that you cannot be relying on putting all your eggs in the same basket. That's another one. But it's bigger than that, because right now, with the climate and environmental agenda, for example, or the digital economy picking up so fast, there are no global rules for any of that stuff. And the reality is that countries are putting in place policies that tend to be fragmented. They don't coordinate with anybody else. So carbon emissions, for example, Europe now has CBAM, the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism. They are taxing imports, or they will be taxing imports of products that are high on carbon emissions, steel, on cement or fertilizers. All those are going to be, there will be an additional tax. Now, what that means at the end of the day is that trade in those products is going to be more expensive. It will require different suppliers, and there is today no coordinated effort to regulate these policies.
We talked about friendshoring, and for China, it is somewhat of a problematic term, because how do you define your friend? How do you define your opponent? When you talk about politically aligned trading partners, there is an ideological factor in there. And for China, a lot of Chinese companies, this may be unfair, although they may have to accept it, but this could be unfair. Okay, for the sake of assuring the safety or reliability of your supply chain, it is understandable, but based on ideology, based on political, what is your comment to that?
Well, I think it's the world's not fair, and I don't think that is fair, frankly. But at the end of the day, what many Chinese companies are doing is they're diversifying their production. So they're not producing only on China. They're setting up shop in different countries, in different geographies, and so that if there is a particular incident that provokes a sanction or something against China, those companies that are Chinese companies, they are also supplying the customers from plants based in other geographies, and that's a way to minimize the impact.
Do you think it is a sustainable trend? Do you think this is this trend that can mitigate some of the risks that people were trying to avert, and that global trade can grow healthily on top of such a trend?
It could be better if we didn't have those sanctions and those barriers in place. But at the end of the day, that's a reality. I don't think that in the near future you will see those tensions disappearing. Mm. They may diminish, they may increase, but they're going to be present somehow. So we have to mitigate the risks in any way we can. Mm.
So under your capacity, as I said, you successfully helped reach the first agreement for the World Trade Organization in its 18 years, which is on trade facilitation. Given the geopolitical headwinds, what do you think can be some of the solutions that countries can agree on so that trade is not disrupted more based on ideology, for instance?
Ideally, we would have more dialogue, and we would try to figure ways of doing things collectively. Although in the WTO, for example, collectively usually means everyone. So a fully multilateral agreement means all 160-some members of the WTO have to agree to, and it's extremely difficult with the different ideological trends, with the different economic trends or economic cycles. It is therefore necessary to be more flexible in the negotiations. So we have seen recently in the WTO some joint initiatives by countries that don't require all members to agree, but if you have a significant number of like-minded countries that want to negotiate a particular set of rules, they can try to do that. This is not yet a path that is 100% agreed, that everybody agrees that this is the way forward. Many have issues with this notion of what we call plurilateral, so not everyone, but many. Mm. But I think pragmatically, if we don't find flexibility to negotiate agreements and to move forward, it is going to be nearly impossible to have more rules, more agreements, and the WTO will suffer because there will be other forums that are going to negotiate these things and not in the WTO. So therefore, less inclusive forums.
Yeah, so the WTO has to stay relevant, has to continue to be able to play a role. I do want to use this opportunity to help bring some clarity to some concepts which people talk about all the time, and yet it seems that there are different understanding. For instance, the preconceived idea that trade somehow is not a win-win solution, but if one sells, the other buys, it seems that one is losing. If you're paying others, you're losing money. If you're importing, you're gaining money. And hence, if you have a large trade deficit, you are at a disadvantage. And when you have a trade surplus, you have a big money reserve, as if that is the way to go. So help us understand, help us put in straightforward terms exactly, is there a losing side and a winning side in terms of trade?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think trade is a win-win. What we have to be mindful of is that trade is fair, that no one is shortchanging the other. So one argument, for example, that I heard quite a bit in the WTO is, I have a trade deficit because the imports that are coming into my country are unfairly produced. Because there is a lot of subsidies, there's a lot of incentives, or there is artificial measures that are promoting those exports, and I am not competing with the private sector, I'm competing against the treasury of the other country. So I heard that quite a bit in the WTO. But that's not always the case. And by the way, sometimes, depending on the economy, on the structure of the economy, in some countries, when you are importing more than normal, it usually means your economy is growing. So you have a lot of capital equipment that is coming, or the productive system is importing more to produce and therefore export. So in the first moment, you have a negative. So you import a lot more than you did before, but in the future, you kind of rebalance things. But it's not a bad sign, actually. It depends on the economy, on the circumstances.
Yeah. Well, let's take the case of the United States as a concrete example, because that is where this argument is also being very strongly promoted, that because the U.S. imports a lot of stuff from China, they have a big trade deficit with China, therefore they're being raped by the Chinese economy. Is that the correct way to see it?
Well, the U.S. argument is basically that China is not exactly a market economy. That's their argument. I'm not saying that they're right in that argument, but that's usually the argument. So what you hear is that China has become such a powerhouse not because the private sector has developed or innovated or become more productive. It's because the government is providing incentives that are artificial, and therefore the imports coming from China are unfairly advantaged compared to production in the United States. That's usually the argument that I hear. It's a very complex conversation, as you can imagine.
So who has the burden to prove that this is not the case? Because sometimes we here are so often arguing a topic where we are accused of something, then we are we have the burden to prove, or China has the burden to prove that it didn't do, although China says it has done a lot, for instance, in opening its sector, right, opening and reforming its legislations to facilitate international competition and so on and so forth.
Well, that's where the dispute settlement mechanism of the WTO was very helpful, because you would have a third party, completely impartial, that would take a look at the arguments and try to decide, you know, who was right and who was wrong. But normally, it's the party that accuses the other of being unfair that has the burden of proof. So in the WTO, if you claim that subsidies provided in China are affecting your production or your world market share, the burden is on you. I actually litigated against the US on a case of cotton, because the US was providing cotton subsidies to their producers. And I was, as Brazil, challenging the US, saying those subsidies were taking share away from Brazilian producers unfairly. But the burden of proof was on me. I had to prove that those subsidies actually had a direct impact on the Brazilian producers. Yeah.
As a matter of fact, when the U.S. accused China of unfair competition, of ripping off the U.S. economy, it is the United States that has to prove that China did that. Right, the burden of proof is on their side, but it seems that it's a very simplistic discussion. They're using the huge amount of trade deficit, for instance, as some kind of evidence.
Legally, the burden of proof is on the accuser, always.
Yeah.
Right, but politically, not always. It's easy to accuse somebody and not have to show, you know, evidence that actually confirms that. And when you're talking about economic impact of domestic measures, it's very complex to show the effect, the quantify the impact, and make the case. So it's a lot easier to just claim things than to actually prove things. And the easy narrative is often absorbed by the public.
Another easy narrative is national security. I'm sure you have noticed it has been invoked very often. Again, you know, Chinese-made products, Chinese-made agricultural products sometimes can be accused of, you know, a national security threat to the United States, for instance. Under the WTO rule, under what circumstances can you invoke this kind of reason to take certain measures? How is transparency and fairness can be ensured in such cases?
It's a very difficult conversation, because at the end of the day, the main challenge, the main difficulty for somebody who invokes national security, the language in the agreement is very vague, right? It allows members to, in certain circumstances, invoke national security interests to apply exceptional measures. Now, the question is it an unfettered right that you can claim that anything is national security and do it, or do you have the burden of showing that it actually has an impact on your national security and therefore you're entitled to apply it? Some countries claim that it is up to the country that is invoking national security to decide what is national security. Mm. Others say this is not a blank check. You still have to show that it is somehow related to your national security.
Yeah.
And that's a big discussion. We had at least a couple of cases in the WTO dispute settlement system. The invocation of national security withstood, but it was a clear case of very concrete geopolitical tension. The party invoking it proved that it was correct in doing so.
Yeah. Well, the problem here is, seems that it involves major countries. You know, we're talking about the United States or European Union against China, major economies, and they cannot agree on what defines or what qualifies the invocation of this provision. What do you do? How can you solve this? You know, because then today is national security, iPhones on wheels, meaning new energy vehicles. The next day can be something else. How can you define, where are the rules then?
So that's precisely what the dispute settlement mechanism of the WTO did, right? Was in an unbiased way, look at the situation and decide whether something was national security or not. But it was still very difficult, you know, for a panel of experts to decide whether something was indeed a national security issue or not. The best thing would be to find a political accommodation and understanding among the players, among the countries involved. But as you can imagine, it's not easy to find that understanding and that accommodation. So there is no easy answer for that. We may see that happening every once in a while, and it will be difficult to find a balanced solution.
Yeah, so basically you mean that China and the US, for instance, would have to come to some sort of political agreement between themselves.
If you don't have a third party, like a dispute settlement mechanism or judges or arbitrators looking at the issue, at the end of the day, the two would have, there is no third supranational body that will say you're right, you're wrong. We don't have that in global governance. So the ideal would be that the countries themselves would come to an understanding.
So what form? People were talking about like an investment agreement or something like that. Would that be helpful? Do you see any prospect of such an agreement? Because right now it seems that, you know, you're playing by your rules, I'm playing by my rules, and it's disruptive.
Agreements are always the best way of doing things, because the two sides sat down, they discussed, and they came to an understanding. So some middle ground was found. Clearly that is a desirable path. But in this particular situation, I find it very difficult to find those agreements being negotiated. Although I think they have to be, you have to try. I mean, there is no other way of doing this other than through dialogue. And we have to find the space to have that dialogue ongoing. But it's not going to be easy. It's going to be much more challenging than people normally imagine.
I can imagine. Well, one more key word that's on the lips of a lot of people, especially in Europe, are subsidies. Because there are, as I said, Chinese new energy vehicles are exporting rapidly. And there is impression that China is able to produce so many new energy vehicles and exporting them so fast only because of subsidies. So what kind of subsidies are WTO prohibiting? Are all subsidies bad or, you know, prohibited?
Not all of them are the same. So there are prohibited subsidies, and the prohibited subsidies are those that are contingent on exports. In other words, I'm giving you this help, this subsidy, and in receiving that, you are committed to export a certain amount of cars, in that case, or a certain value, or there is some degree of contingency. So if you don't export, you don't get my subsidy. You have to export to get this. That is prohibited.
Okay.
You cannot do that. But if it is a domestic subsidy, if you're subsidizing an industry because it's an infant industry, or because for any reason you want to develop that sector in your country, that's permissible. But you cannot do it in such a way that would provoke or cause material damage to the trade and to the economy of other WTO members.
I want to ask you about the prospects for trade for China and your impressions. You just traveled here. You've seen a little bit of China. You have also been following China's growth. China's trade numbers last year overall was 0.2% up increase year on year. Import was Slightly down 0.3%, export 0.6% up. So against the 5% drop globally, these are okay number, but how do you comment on China's trade performance and going further, the kind of resilience of Chinese trading capabilities?
I think looking only at the numbers of Chinese trade performance, it doesn't tell the whole story. Early on in the WTO, China, when China joined the WTO, was a producer of products and exporter of products that had low value added, like textiles, for example, even steel. So commoditized products. China has evolved quite significantly. I think China now, in the digital space, for example, in services, in artificial intelligence. So China is moving up in terms of value added. And that, I think, is much more important than the numbers, is the quality of the trade, the quality of the economy, what kind of products, what kind of technologies, which spaces is China now participating. I would say, rather than focusing on the values and the numbers, that is important, of course, to take a look at. But that's not the only indicator. There is much more that would be relevant in indicating how healthy the Chinese economy is.
Well, it's been very helpful, Mr. Azevedo, to have all of these discussions so that I'm a bit more clear on these concepts so I can do hopefully better shows in the future. Thank you so much, Roberto Azevedo, former Director General of the World Trade Organization, for talking to us.
So thank you. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Thank you. And with that, we come to the end of this special edition of The Point with me, Liu Xin. As always, you can follow me on Facebook and Twitter using the handle Liu Xin in Beijing.